Hello and welcome to Parkinson's Pathway Pals Tuesdays with Teresa. I'm Teresa Jackson, your podcast host. Today, my guest is Dr. Michael Okun. Dr. Michael Okun obtained his MD with honors from the University of Florida, as well as his residency in neurology, and was the chief resident at the University of Florida. He received his fellowship training at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, before he moved to found the Movement Disorder Program at the University of Florida. He is currently chair of neurology, professor and executive director of the Norman Fixel Institute for Neurological Diseases at the University of Florida Health College of Medicine. He has an active research career. He's published 406 peer-reviewed articles, 80 review articles, and 10 books. He was recognized in a 2015 White House ceremony by the Obama administration as a champion for change for Parkinson's disease. Well known as a world Parkinson's leader, Dr. Okun shares his expertise and medical perspective on Parkinson's disease and how to best manage it. Welcome, Dr. Okun.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here with you, Teresa. It's great. And thank you for all you're doing for the community.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to have you. I know your time is very valuable, but I know you're very passionate about this topic. So let's dive right in. I think that when people are diagnosed, they usually start at their primary care, and then they're sent, if they're lucky, they're sent to a neurologist, right? But I think people don't understand the difference necessarily between a neurologist and a movement disorder specialist, and why it's important that if they have the option to at least see a movement disorder specialist one time at least. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think this is a super important point. And in fact, if you go on Google, nobody searches for a movement disorder specialist on Google. You know, so I learned this in working as the medical director, medical advisor for the Parkinson's Foundation that, you know, why would people know like the difference between a movement or a neuromuscular or an epilepsy doctor? You just know, look, I've got an issue and I need a doctor or I need a healthcare professional, not necessarily always a doctor. And it turns out that, you know, when you have a syndrome like Parkinson's, that some expertise matters. It's a little more complicated than, you know, some of the things that you might see that are colds and flus and things like that. And not to say anything disparaging about any of the rest of the healthcare field, but, you know, having expertise matters. And I have a friend at the University of Pennsylvania named Allison Willis, who also sits on the editorial board of JAMA Neurology with me. And she writes a lot about this. And she has some really wonderful papers where she actually shows that if you connect with just a neurologist, not even a neurologist associated with Parkinson and movement, that's even a step larger. Most people don't get access. If you look at Medicare data, people that have Parkinson's, persons with Parkinson's that see a neurologist have less morbidity, that means healthcare problems, less mortality, that means death, and less placement into nursing home facilities. And so it makes a difference. Now, we train past just neurology trainings. That's just general neurology. So even getting to a neurologist regularly important. If you can get to a movement neurologist, so important because the disease, it's dynamic, it moves, it changes, and you have to change with it. And it takes some expertise, it takes time. I always say it takes 15 minutes to take the medication history. And so you got to spend time, and people don't necessarily have the time, the resources, and also the expertise to help. And we train about 40 or 50 people in movement disorders. So there comes that name that nobody really cares about. Well, let's call it a Parkinson neurologist. We train 40 or 50 a year. Oh my, 40 or 50 a year. Think about that. That's it. You're talking about the fastest growing disease on the planet in neuro, and the neurosphere is now Parkinson. We only train 40 or 50 a year. And so getting people to neurologists around the world is important, step one. And then getting people at least to some level of care with some expertise, even if it's remote or other things, we've got to do better at this, makes a huge difference, Teresa.
Yeah, and I think telemed has really opened up a lot of opportunities for people that maybe they can travel once, but they can't travel routinely. And then it also allows that collaboration. If you can't travel routinely between a movement disorder specialist and your neurologist, because of telemed. So I think that's a fortunate thing for patients, but they have to know about it, right?
Absolutely.
So speaking of movement disorder specialists and neurologists, when I was diagnosed personally, I didn't receive any education on what resources were out there. And God forbid you get on a thread on Facebook, right? Everybody's grandpa died of Parkinson's, and it's just overwhelming. So people need to know where to get information, reliable, reputable, accurate information. And the lack of education at the time of diagnosis is why I do what I do. So I'm wondering if you can talk about what do we need to do about that? People need to understand what you have and what you don't have, and then how you manage it. And I think, you do a really good job of talking about that in your book, Living with Parkinson's Disease, but people don't necessarily know about these resources, and they're so overwhelmed at the time of diagnosis. What do we do?
Yeah, so great question. One that we should be squarely focused on. It's like you got to walk before you run, and people just don't get how impactful it is to hear the four words, "You have Parkinson's disease." It's gonna pierce the dreams. It's gonna rob the humanity of 50,000 or more people, every year and growing, right? It's just it. And it's hard, like as you hear those words, those four words, it's hard to process anything after that. And we asked folks, back when we wrote the book, 10 Secrets to a Happier Life. And, by the way, more people read that book that we wrote than any of the hundreds of research articles and things I've done in my laboratory career. It's very humbling, but it tells you that people are hungry for information. And as you pointed out, the first lesson in that book, same in the Living with Parkinson's Disease book, the first lesson is know the signs, know what they are. And I always show this picture, and no, there's no malcontent, or I don't want to cause any fights with Alzheimer's disease, but knowing the signs is I have a picture of a sign from the Alzheimer's Foundation that has an arrow toward Alzheimer's disease, knowing that you don't have Alzheimer's disease. And most people think they have Alzheimer's disease or an equivalent to Alzheimer's disease or ALS or a brain tumor. In other words, they equate those four words to the worst possible thing that they could have. And so knowing what you have and what you don't have is important. Knowing that you can live a great life, with a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease is important. And knowing that we're all mortal, right? We all are mortal, okay? We got to live our best lives possible. And knowing that there are so many things we can do. And I think that's the reason that book from 2013 resonated and still stays up there and people still read it and talk about it. It's because the message is that message that there are things that you can do. And then in terms of thinking about resources, I've worked with the Parkinson's Foundation. We run this great helpline, 1-800, the number 4-PD-INFO. For those that are too young to know, there are on your telephone keypad, there are letters next to the number. So 1-800-4-PD-INFO, you can dial that. And we have healthcare professionals, not just nurses, who are the best. And I meet with them once a month. They take questions from all over the planet, free of charge. Just so great, so inspirational. They have free books up on the Parkinson Foundation website. They have the PD Generation Project. So there's a whole bunch of things that you can get involved with and learn. And part of it is the journey. And I always come back to philosophy. So Lu Xun said that there were no roads until people walked on them. And I love that, his writings, because as when we talk about Parkinson's, we need to not only help people to get on the road, but we need to help them on their journey. And so this has been a super important learning and a humbling thing for me. Every day I practice medicine, I know a little less. So how we approach this is important, and we need to encourage people to understand, particularly those who are primary care doctors making the diagnosis and neurologists, how important those moments are and how it's going to stick and how not everybody has Alzheimer's disease. And so it's not just teaching the persons with the disease what they have and what they don't have. It's actually teaching the same lesson to our healthcare professionals across the board. And we just need to do a better job. And so it's on us. And so, Teresa, we have to take a little blame here. We can't just, we need to do better.
So that kind of segues into my next thought. And clearly, there is an onus on the physician. But I think the patient also, once they realize and they've been diagnosed, like they're key in this whole equation. And when I present and teach, I always talk to the patient about how can you best prepare for your physician visit so that you know you're feeding your physician information that is useful. It's one thing to show up and say, "Oh, I'm doing okay." What does that mean? Well, it means I can barely walk to the post office or to the mailbox, but I want to take my grandkids to Disney World and I don't have the fatigue. I don't have enough energy because of fatigue. I guess I'm looking for you from the physician point of view. I know from the patient point of view, but from the physician point of view, how does a patient best prepare or what kind of information helps you to make their appointment better, which in turn makes their quality of life better?
Yeah, so this is actually a great question, Teresa. So it sounded like you were hesitant to ask the question, but let me tell you, this is a great question and one we get quite a bit, both in our own practice, at University of Florida at the Fixell Institute, but also through the Parkinson Foundation. It turns out it's just like good mentorship. It's just like good meetings, coming prepared. So you can get so much more if you come prepared. And so it's the difference between being reactive to everything and being proactive. Okay. So the first thing I teach people is, the healthcare providers that tell you don't read about your disease, don't read anything, throw that out. Okay. That's not a good approach. It might cost us more time to spend with folks, but having people be uneducated, even if they go get the wrong information on the internet, having the conversation to figure out what's right or wrong, that's part of the role of, of the doctor in the village. When there's one doctor in a village, a lot of times that might be the only person who reads or writes historically, right? And so they teach. Their doctor means teacher, right? And so we need to teach people and allow people to learn and go through, and then they'll learn, where is good information and what is not, by having the conversation and the dialogue. So first of all, I think it's super important that we encourage people to seek information. Second, we should not ever be punitive about people getting second opinions. If you want to get a second opinion, things aren't going well, you don't feel comfortable, get a second opinion. I love it when my folks that are under my care go get a second opinion. I say, send me the report so I can learn something. Every day I practice medicine, I know a little less. So maybe you can teach me something. Maybe we missed something. And so second opinions are okay. And then third, when you actually come to the visit, having your medications, summarized easily for the, person to see, how you take them with times or a chart or something, super helpful. That could save you some time. And trying to synthesize a little bit, spend a little bit of time synthesizing for the person on the other side. And so if you think about it from a family perspective, and you want to get something out of the visit. So now imagine if you were the person on the other end and you handed somebody 50 pages and you said, or 3 pages, single spaced, and said, synthesize this in 30 minutes or an hour. It's hard. And so I think coming in with the medications, coming in with the three main problems, or in a rank list of things you really want to address. Remembering that it's a marathon. You don't have to solve it all in a day. You can always come back. And there are different things. And sometimes when you solve one problem in Parkinson, it leads to improvements in others. So you never want to actually do more than one thing. You don't want to like solve all these problems, because what if all the problems are linked? Then you got to figure out what's most important, and that will help. And so helping to rank order, giving them information and preparation, but trying to synthesize it a bit can be useful. And being patient and being comfortable in the environment. If you have a good, comfortable relationship where you can tee it up for them, and you can get and then and try not to win it all on day, that can be useful. And finally, if you can get your docs talking to each other, the highest level of healthcare is when people are talking about each other behind their backs. So if you can actually suggest and connect people by email, and we live in a digital world, by email, by however, you can get people talking, sending notes. If you can get people connected, your different members of your healthcare team, you're going to get better care eventually as they begin to row, they'll begin to synchronize. It might be a little tough at first. If you can synchronize people, and then there are certain places like at the Fixell Institute, we've worked for 20 years to synthesize all under one roof, get everybody rowing together, all the different specialties in one time. That's taken time. Most people in the world don't have that. And but working toward that and just understanding that as a core principle can improve your experience, you know, when you go to see someone.
I think that interdisciplinary approach is really important, but not everyone has that. But I think that's really, really important. When I was diagnosed, I think the thing that I fear the worst is not being in a wheelchair. Not that I want to be, but it's not that. It's dementia, Lewy body. Those words to me are frightening. I'm wondering if you can, well, I know you can't, but would you share with us some information on, is there ways to mitigate dementia? The statistics that I read out there are like up to 80% of people with Parkinson's ends up with Parkinson's dementia. So could you talk a little bit around that and what is Lewy body?
Yeah, we recently did an educational event in Times Square with a group called Metaflix, and we each kind of did a thing where they shined a light and everything. And I'm glad you brought this up because that was the issue that I chose. You know, each one of us that was on the panel, they put the spotlight on us on the stage, and we got to riff, you know, a little bit about an issue. And so this is one that is important to me because the fear of this drives so many people. So I think it's important to have the dialogue and to talk about it. First of all, the most important thing is to remember you are not a test, okay? And you know, you are a person. And so understanding that when we give a test, we're using that to track and to see where you are, and giving tests over multiple times helps us. And sometimes when we test for thinking problems, we call that cognitive, but we do thinking tests and a whole bunch of different things. We're just looking at the different lobes of your brain, right? And how they work. And what's really interesting is people that have what's called mild cognitive impairment. That means they have some problem with a domain, like one of those lobes, one of those areas, one of those circuits. Some of those people actually revert back to normal. I'm talking about people without Parkinson as you follow them, and then they fluctuate. So you can fluctuate on different days. So it's important to have these things over time. And then just because you have, you know, abnormalities doesn't mean you're demented, okay? And so people, you know, kind of conflate and get confused a little bit. And it's confusing even for me to explain it. And so the best way I can explain it is you do all these paper, pencil, and thinking tests, right? They're testing the different lobes of your brain, and they want to see how you're doing over time. Almost all, pretty much all Parkinson folks are going to have problems with their frontal lobes and their memory. All. It doesn't mean that you don't function, right? But you might, if you had criteria, if you were a researcher, you might start classifying people as dementia or not, right? So then you start putting people labels on people, and then you're like, oh my God. And then, you know, and then you have to live with this and you fear it. So the first thing that I always like to riff about is just remember that you are not a test, you are a person, and that we expect you to have frontal and memory issues, okay? And that's okay. And you can function very well with those. Okay. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is that we're all mortal, right? So we want to shoot for not lifespan. We don't want to live forever, okay, because we know that that's not possible. We want to live better. So we want to improve our health span, not our lifespan. And so the job is to improve health span and to help you, give you tips, help you with things. If the thinking or if the memory and things are becoming affected, you know, there are things that you can do to try to sharpen things up. Think about meds, think about other types of rehabilitation strategies, and then just think about, you know, sort of adapting and changing to the challenges as you deal with mortality, whether you have Parkinson or not. You've got to have a plan to deal with the challenges. Okay. There are different subtypes of Parkinson. Some progress faster than others. Some have cognitive dysfunction. Some are what we call cognitive superstars. You may not have heard that. It's a term we use here at Fixell. It's not a scientific term, but we know because we've tested a lot of people for things like deep brain stimulation surgery and everything. And there are people who are just out have outstanding cognition. We have people that go 20, 30, 40 years with Parkinson or more. And we don't tell that story enough. And so, with the Parkinson Foundation and other researchers, a lot of people are working on phenotyping, understanding the differences between Parkinson. And so my thesis on this is to back up a little, try to kind of understand the constructs of the words that you hear, and to not be quite so wounded by the words once we do a better job of explaining it, and not to live your life in fear of this, but to embrace that there's going to be more cognitive issues and challenges. And the biggest one is really we often tell people not to do things. And that's one of the mistakes we make in thinking problems in Parkinson. We say, don't dual task. It's impossible, right? Like you're like, how can you not? Like you have the greatest supercomputer ever above the level of your neck. How can you not multitask? You can't do that. And so what we should be telling people is, instead of don't, which is a negative, we should be proactive, right? We should be saying monotask. So you can try. You can try your best. You're not going to be able to stop that supercomputer, but if you remind yourself to monotask, pay attention to your feet when you walk, pay attention to the book when you're listening to it. Monotask as much as possible. That will help, because oftentimes the thinking breaks down when you dual task. So rather than telling people don't dual task, which is impossible, tell people be proactive and try to focus monotask. So that's the way that at least I've thought about it over a few decades of being in the field.
I think that is like really profound, actually, as simple as it is, but just the reframing of that and to focus on monotask as opposed to the don't multitask. And I also, as I hear you explain that, the word that comes to my mind is hope. And I know hope's not a plan, but it's a motivator. And when you said, we're not telling that story enough of people that are being successful and have quality life for 20, 30, 40 years. And I think hope is just so important for your quality of life. It may not change your trajectory, but it surely changes your outlook. So I guess I'd like to pivot a little bit and talk about sleep disorders. Fatigue is a big issue. A lot of people have REM disorder. So who, if someone has a sleeping issue or a REM disorder, who goes on to develop Parkinson's and who doesn't?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and I'll start again with a little bit of definitions, because it turns out that when we think about, what we call REM sleep behavioral disorder, and REM stands for rapid eye movement. It's where your eyes move rapidly. It's when you go into dream sleep and you start sleeping. So neurologists give names to everything, and neuroscientists, and then they give them a number and then they bill you for it. So, but the REM sleep, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about dream sleep. And during dream sleep, if you measure muscle movement, the muscles aren't supposed to move at all. So if you put these things called EMGs on the muscle, just tape it on the muscle, it becomes completely silent during dream sleep. When you start to move, during dream sleep, and then act out your dreams or get involved with them or start, talking and really getting involved, then they call that REM, rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder or syndrome. And the issue is that people can talk in their sleep, they can move, they can do all sorts of stuff, but it doesn't always mean you have REM sleep behavior disorder. So the first thing I always tell folks is, first of all, don't try to diagnose too much on your own, because just because you're talking a little in your sleep all your life doesn't necessarily mean you have REM sleep disorder. It is a specific disorder, and sometimes you can get a pretty accurate diagnosis based on a history with a good expert neurologist, but sometimes you need a sleep study to be sure that you've got it. So understanding that is important. And one of the really interesting and intriguing things scientifically is that the presence of this disorder is highly associated with depositing a protein in the brain called synuclein, which people have called Lewy bodies. Frederick Lewy was a neurologist who looked at these inclusions under a microscope, and they were called Lewy bodies. And later on, we realized they had a protein called synuclein in them. So synuclein diseases, some people call them synucleinopathies. Parkinson isn't the only one, but synucleinopathies tend to, to swim. So if you're looking at swimming fish, the school of fish tend to swim together. They tend to swim these synucleinopathies along with folks who later get Parkinson's disease. And so it's been one of the things that we're beginning to better understand. It gives us a hint because a lot of times this may present before the motor symptoms or a lot of the motor symptoms. And so people sometimes call these prodromal symptoms or symptoms before the motor symptoms, although there's now debate as to whether or not there's actually motor dysfunction too, and articles and people starting to look at that, but certainly before noticeable motor symptoms in a lot of people. And, so it's not 100% that if you develop an REM sleep behavior disorder, there are other reasons why you can develop different sleep disorders that you're going to get Parkinson, but it's a huge risk factor that that we are beginning to recognize. Now, once the cat's out of the bag and you have it, you can actually be injured from this. You can jump out of bed, you can hit your head, it's not just fighting the bad guys while you're sleeping. And so it is important that it's addressed. It's important for bed partners. It's important for relationships. It's important for your safety. And finally, those who don't get a good night's sleep have a horrible next day. And so treatment of it is really important. If you're a physician, if any doctors, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, anybody that's a healthcare professional that treats patients, if you want persons with disease to love you, give them a good night's sleep and they will love you because their next day will be important. So the fact that we focus so much on the motor symptoms, but not on sleep, non-motor symptoms, fatigue, and other things often come from not having a good night's sleep. You had mentioned fatigue. And so it's a really important message for folks.
Yeah, I look at that as like, you've got your sleep, your nutrition, your exercise, your hydration. So it's like a chair. But if you knock the leg out of in sleep, then the chair's not gonna sit very well. So it's pretty important. There's lots of things that we could talk about. I'm gonna have to have you back another time. I hope that you'll do that. But I think I would like to shift to what's in the pipeline. Everyone wants to know about a cure. I'm curious if you think is ending Parkinson's within our reach? And then also, what's in the pipeline for things like managing dyskinesia?
Yeah, so good question. So first of all, I try to stay a bit agnostic and neutral about all the different types of things that are happening because I find that we all criticize each other probably too much, right? And we learn as much from our failures as we do from our successes. And the problem, well, we wrote the book, Ray Dorsey, myself, Boston Bloom, Todd Scherer. When we wrote the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, and by the way, there's a House bill and a Senate bill that is bipartisan, been introduced of the same name as that book, and talked about the construct of ending Parkinson's disease and what folks had done for other diseases to sort of, move the needle. One of the things that we found was very important was that Parkinson is receiving less than 10 times what it will need to move the needle in research dollars. And then we all fight with each other about, like the failures and we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't do that. But if you look at history, we learn more from our failures than from our successes. So it's just important we broaden out our thinking. We can't be afraid to fail. We can't be afraid to try some things that are a little out of the box and crazy and know that that can also lead to breakthroughs and ways of thinking through things and the dialogues that are going to push the field forward. We studied polio, HIV, and other diseases, breast cancer, and how they move the needle. And we came up with the idea that it was a pact. You have to focus on prevention, advocacy, care, and development of new treatments. Each of the letters stands for one of the important concepts, one of the important constructs. And so in Parkinson, there's a lot of areas that are exciting me, the neuroimmunology, neuroinflammation area. Early days for vaccines, probably going to be a little too late. The way the vaccines are going against synuclein, by the time synuclein gets in the brain, might be too late. Could be wrong, but it might be too late. And so monoclonal antibodies you saw in the New England Journal, two recent studies did failed, and we're probably looking a little too late. But again, the failure helps us to refocus and recalibrate our system, right? A lot of interesting things in understanding that pathway and where we can intervene. Nutritional things, diet, microbiome, using AI to understand the microbiome and ways we can be better for prevention, preventing environmental things. I always joke, my great friend and colleague Ray Dorsey washes his fruit, because of paraquat and everything, super important. And then when you look at something like you mentioned, one of many things, everybody has something that they are thinking about. When you're thinking about dyskinesia, we have an old therapy that still works better than any of the new therapies, and that's changing the medications, management, timing, and how we dose. And then the old therapy is amantadine, decommissioned by the CDC. We used to be an old-fashioned antiviral, works on multiple dopaminergic systems, but also on the glutamate system in the brain. And we still don't understand why we can't get another drug to work as well as amantadine. And so understanding the biology is important. There's a great article by Cora DeHimpteen and Nikki Swan and Phil Starr at University of California, San Francisco, looking at this peak that they see in people getting deep brain stimulation when they become dyskinetic, this gamma peak, and understanding that and how the cells are behaving during dyskinesia. Stella Papa at Emory, where I used to be many years ago, did the original work on showing how in animals the firing rate goes down during dyskinesia. And then looking broadly, there's a cannabinoid system. We're excited about understanding that system in the brain, how that can be harnessed. There's a cholinergic system, there's a dopaminergic system, there's a glutamatergic system, we think, but we're not sure, or the glutamatergic dopaminergic together and the amantadine, we're not sure the magic. We haven't been able to reproduce it yet. So there's a whole bunch of things that are going on. And then, of course, the best suppressor of dyskinesia to date, bar none, has been palatal stimulation, stimulation of the GPI, and deep brain stimulation in that area. So there's a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of approaches, and I like to keep an open mind, and I want people to keep failing. And that may sound crazy to you, but our innovation is going to become through people having great ideas and trying them and being willing to fail. Of course, we don't want to hurt patients in the process. So I want to say that out front, but we're going to need a lot of failures to get to successes, Teresa.
I think everyone wants a cure, whether you're dealing with personally dealing with Parkinson's or someone you love or some, it's your life work. But I think for most Parkinson's or for many people that are living with Parkinson's, if we could find a treatment that was effective or stop the progress and was effective, that'd feel like a cure to them. If I can just go on with my daily life, it would feel like a cure. I'm so grateful for you for all the things that you're doing for the Parkinson's community and for the time that you've given me today. That's so valuable. I would just like to ask you, what else would you like for our listeners to know that you think is important if they're living with Parkinson's? And then also, if there's anything that in particular that you would like to talk about, Norman Fixell Institute, I'd love for you to share that.
Yeah, so first of all, the one message I would have for folks is just realize, you can live a great life with Parkinson. Okay. We're all mortal. There is a path. Seek the path and just lean in and just and maybe think philosophically a little bit different about your own mortality and about humanity and about what you want to do with your minutes on the earth. And I just believe that deeply after doing this for many years, and particularly since writing that book, 10 Secrets to a Happier Life. I really believe that. Second, amplify our voices. Feel free to join our discussions. We have discussion forums. We've got the on the Parkinson website, there are lots of other great foundations, Michael J. Fox Foundation, not just the Parkinson's Foundation, APDA, others. Get involved, amplify our voices. We're not loud enough. The A is for advocacy and PACT, prevent, advocate, care, develop treatments. We need the A. We need to be much more aggressive, much more involved, and not beat each other up for our failures. in terms of the Norman Fixell Institute, something we're super proud of, continues to be built out as a campus and hopefully a model place where all the services are in one place. Things are coordinated for you. You're not just fighting for parking. You know, we're tracking your outcomes and database, giving you access to trials and all the different folks in one place. We've got peaceful paths, and we think about the family experience and these types of things. It's not just the Norman Fixell Institute. You know, we think that there's a path forward with Centers of Excellence and Parkinson Foundation and others to creating better environments, better ways to do things. And if we amplify our voices, we can start to convince folks that that are going to spend the dollars in governments around the world to invest and move the, I like to say, move the chess pieces in a different way. And you might save billions of dollars on falls and fractures and comorbidities and keeping people out of the hospital. And everybody could win if we did this a little differently. And so Norman Fixell is an institute that's in Gainesville, Florida, and it is at the center of our hearts. And, you know, join us. Come on to Twitter. I'm on Twitter all the time. Just use my name, Michael Oken. Join us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. Get part of the conversation. And it's fun, it's important, and it's meaningful. And try to find the meaning in your life with Parkinson, meaning of life, meaning in life, and lean in, and we'll try to help you on our journey.
I love that. I think collectively we can always do better than any singular thought. So I love that. And I think also when you think about preventative care, you know, we're going to spend the money. We're going to spend it either in aftercare after you've been diagnosed with whatever, or we can spend it in preventative type care. So I think the money is going to be spent either way. And your thought of where we put it is, I think, one to really listen to. I want to thank you for sharing your expertise today. And I want to thank my listeners for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, and I'll see you Tuesday.
All right. Awesome.